Augustine, who wrote around the 400, one of his most famous writings was The City of God. But he also wrote a thing called De Trinitas, which is on the Trinity. I just picked up his title and put it on here. This has not got anything to do with Augustine's rendition. Okay. Now, what I want to do tonight with you is to say, hang with me at least this one more session for some foundational teaching on the concept of the Trinity. Tonight we're not going to get into models, but try to understand what the concept of the Trinity entails in terms of our faith. And so I've made a few notes here, and I'll go across those fairly quickly. And then I have another handout to give you, and we'll center our last thoughts on that one. Okay, the Trinity. Number one, a finite man using finite language to describe an infinite God, what do you come up with? Incomplete. fall short. You know, we cannot conceive of God outside of our finite existence. And so whenever you try to say God is, then we're a finite person using finite language to describe an infinite God. And number two, having said that, it is to say that the Trinity at best will be incomplete. Our concept of Trinity, our concept of God will be incomplete. It will not, you know, in theology they use this term exhaustive. It will not be exhaustive. It will not cover and complete the project. It'll be partial at best. And yet, as Augustine said, we strain at describing the infinite and we'll fall short. But we must at least try. We cannot just ignore the issues that are raised if we don't try to look at the concept of God. In that the scriptures, number two, the scriptures force us to the concept of a multiplicity in God. Jesus, was declared by Thomas to be my Lord and my God. Jesus doesn't rebuke him. When Jesus says the Father and I are one, he was making himself equal with God. Philippians says, even though he was in equality with God, he felt it not a thing to be grasped, but did what? Emptied himself. Okay, so the scriptures force us that, even from the very beginning in the creation account, let us make man in our image. And that has a multiplicity type of language to it. Isaiah 6, when Isaiah was in the temple, I saw the Lord high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple, and the seraphim went over and cried, holy, 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 and took a coal off of the altar and touched my lips and said, for I said I'm a man of unclean lips dwelling on the people of unclean. And the seraphim went over and touched my lip and said I was clean. And in that exchange, as Isaiah was looking into the throne room of God, there was the comment there, who will we send? Who will we send? Who will go for us? And that comes out there. John 1, the Word was with God. Jesus was with God, yet was God. And that's just a few of the many we've looked at. Number three, the incarnation. Incarnate means to take on body. God doesn't have a body. He is not defined by spatial limits. Do you understand the concept of pantheism? Theism is the word for God. Pan is all. So what is pantheism? God is everything. And so we're a piece of God, you know, in that kind of concept. Okay. Incarnation. God is, not like us, embodied. In the incarnation, Jesus became human, and dwelt among us. Is Jesus then deity? And of course we're pushed to that because of the scriptures. And so, Jesus deity, once we go to the fact that Jesus is deity, he's either one with God or he is a lesser God. And we know that in Gnosticism, they considered that the spiritual realm was such that there was a good God and there were lesser gods. And the lesser God made the material world, which is evil. And we've got to escape and try to get back to the good God. Jesus is not a lesser God. He, you know, it's either God with a capital G or not God. In the Greek spiritual worldview, there are all kinds of gods. You know, Zeus and Jupiter and all the dead one. But anyhow, when we talk about the Trinity, when we say three persons, that is anthropomorphic. Anthropos is the word for man. Morphe is shape. We're shaping God in the shape of man when we say three persons. When you say, and you've heard me enough now to know that that is an English rendition that the early theologians did not give. They said he is not three persons. They said he was three persona. Persona. And persona was a mask that someone wore to hide who they were to be the character that the mask represents. Three persons is really the three. It's because when we think of three persons, then the Godhead is a round table with three people sitting around it and trying to arm wrestle and figure out what we're going to do. Now, the Godhead being plurality, there has to be distinctiveness in the Godhead, but a single divine light. Now, you know at Nicaea, the one word that they wrestled over was homoousios, homoiousios. The I was the only, was the two, is the difference in the two words. Homoousios means of the same substance. Homoiousios was similar. And they fought for the difference in those two words. That Jesus, it was of the same substance of God. In other words, when we think of the word substance even, we think of atoms and molecules and things of that nature. Well, God's not made up of atoms, molecules, and that kind of stuff. Whatever the stuff God's made of it, Jesus is part of that same stuff. Okay? Now I'm gonna, this early on here, just bear with me. I gotta say it just because it needs to be said, and then we're gonna get at some other things, okay? Now, I pushed the word at you, immanent. You know, God is transcendent. He is over all things. And he is present. The distinctions inside the Godhead, are they distinctions simply inside or simply outward activities, the way God works differently? Now, just hold that one, number five. And let's go on. I got two number fives here. I wrestle with this cotton picking computer. Every time I put a number down, it goes this and it puts the next one. And I try to, if I change my mind and want to change something, anyhow, I hit Control Z 100 times and I still can't make it quit putting the numbers in there. So anyhow, I didn't notice that was there until I'm looking at it right now. The second five said, all right, the preexistence of Christ. The fact that Christ is preexistent, he didn't come into being when he came to the earth. The fact that he's pre-existent, it shows that he is part of a distinction in the Godhead. He is distinct in some sense from God and yet in unity with God. Now, the distinction is part of the language of the Trinity at all the creeds. They are distinct but one. They are separate but unity. And you know, you say, well, which one is it? You can't have it both ways. But that is there. We'll get there in just a minute. Now, here's the problem, okay? Now, if we speak of God as the first cause, uncreated, eternal, what are we saying about the nature of God? Simple language. He always has been, always is. He is uncreated, eternal. If he's the first cause of all that is made, he has to be himself not caused, or he's not the first cause. He's a cause in a line of succession of causes. Okay? And he has to be uncreated because he can't create himself. And if he's the cause of all that's created, then he has to be uncreated. Okay. Now, if God is that first cause, uncreated, eternal being, then he has to be complete within himself. Okay? Now, we say that God is personal, has that quality of person. We say personal versus a thing. God's not a rock. He's personal. Okay? We would say God has being. You know, that's the statement at Moses at the burning bush. God said, I am. You know, in essence, it's saying, I am the source of being. I am. Okay. So God is complete. God is personal, not a thing. We say that God is love. Okay. Can you have the concept of love without an object to love? If you say someone is loving, does it require that there be something that demonstrates they are by their actions or attitude toward an object?
Only if you need proof.
Yeah. But you understand, you know, love, to say someone is loving or that they love is to describe how they respond, react, or act towards something else. If we say someone is cruel, we would demonstrate that by what? Their action, what they've done, what they've done to something other than themselves. You know, if you're cruel to yourself, you're just an idiot. You know, I mean, you know, now, what we're doing then, when you start putting these concepts together, God is personal. Now, he is being, and we say personal, he is relational. Okay? Was God personal, loving, before he created or after he created?
Yes.
Both. Okay. If he was loving and personal, relational. If he was relational, meaning he, you know, he's in some kind of relates to someone, and he is loving, God doesn't become relational, doesn't become loving when he creates an object to love. So, if God is love and relational, then the distinctions in the Godhead of Father, Son, and Spirit, and are these created? No. Are they eternal? Part of the Godhead means that then if this distinction in the makeup of God, which is different than anything we know of in the finite world. Okay. Now, we're in that first sentence, finite man, finite language, describing an infinite God. We don't have anything like that we can deal with. But our concept of God, it should not surprise us to come to realize that God was able to be loving and relational within his own being because of the distinctiveness of Father, Son, and Spirit within the Godhead. Okay? So he's complete. See, God didn't create so that he could complete himself. God didn't create so because he needed somebody to love. That's what I was told when I was growing up. God needed somebody to love, so he created us. And I said, well, he should have made a better shot than that. We're not very lovable, you know. But you understand that then when you get down to here where we says here in Numbers, in my number 7 now, we have being, we have existence, we have personality. It's an expression of God's being and personality, meaning that God's not a thing, that God's alive and has personality. We should find in God the ground for all we discover in his works. Relation within the divine being should not be surprising. For God to be a thinking being, he needs an internal object in himself. As a moral being, he needs to be able to function morally within the Godhead. Personality must be expressed and realized in connection with others. The will must have an object for its action of its will. Love must have an object which is also eternal. Love is not created. It's part of the identity of God. Go down to number 8. God's goal for creation of nature and man is that he wanted to put in place a moral kingdom of persons who had come to be redeemed through Christ. This goal is grounded in his nature. Now, go back and understand. God wants to create a moral kingdom of persons redeemed through Christ, which is part of the Godhead. It's grounded in his nature. God, being loving, wants to create something that is an expression of himself. Physical nature is a means to this personal, moral, and social end. He created a physical world where we could be persons in it, we could make moral choices, and become connected together. The image of God appears in these recreated persons in Christ. God's goal was to actualize good, bring into reality that which existed only as potential. Now, I'm going to give you another handout. And this one I want to talk about God's goal of actualizing good. Now, we do not have a straightforward statement in the scriptures that says this is the reason God decided to create. Okay? If God created because he needed something, then God is not complete in himself. And he can't be God if he's not complete in himself. Because he's not Well, he's just not complete. He's incomplete, and he makes something to complete himself with. And if he's not complete, how can he survive without something that completes him? So, you know, now, so God is personal. He relates, relational, and he relates within the distinctiveness of the Godhead. Once again, not a concept that we can be saying we have a good model of, okay? But logically, it has to work that way. Or you don't have a first cause that can be a first cause. The first cause is not dependent on anything else. It is full, it is complete within itself. We are not. We had to be made. We can't make ourselves. And there had to be things made to sustain us before we were made. Oxygen had to be here. Carbon had to be here. You know, all that kind of stuff. Now, it is a good exercise to stop and say, well, then why did God create? You know, I was told as a kid that, you know, salvation came about when God discovered there are people walking around on the earth and decided he'd send Jesus down there to redeem them. Well, that's not the way it happened. You know, I mean, it's not the way it happened. The creation is not something that happened upon God. And humanity is not something that happened upon God. Paul said before God laid the foundation of the earth, he planned the program where he put free moral agents in this world that he creates with the potential and opportunity to be recreated by the Son who would come. And then we would be reunited with God after a time of being here. Now, why God was willing to get going with that project is one that, we can only surmise. You know, it's part of the thing of detractors to Christianity, critics of Christianity says that an all good and all powerful God wouldn't create a world where there's evil, pain, and suffering. In response to that, people say, but a person would create allowing pain, evil, and suffering for a greater good. Well, what is the greater good? And is the greater good sufficient to offset the fact that there is such great evil? Now, I'm not going to get into that theodicy, but I'm just, you know, set that up there to say, when God created, there was the potential that the world would get into the shape that it is in. And the reason that there was potential for that was you can't have the potential for good unless you have the potential for the evil. Because that which you create, you can make it so it can't do evil. But then that thing you make is controlled. It's a machine. It's not a person. Now, when you say you want to create a person who will make free moral choices, and one of which is to be recreated in Christ, then they have to have the opportunity to go the other direction, or it's not a, you know, otherwise you are manipulating everything to your own end. Now, you see, God has the right and opportunity to create or not create. He's under no compulsion. He didn't have to create. Some would say, well, God is so loving, he had to create. Well, he didn't have to do anything. He made a choice. And when he made the choice to create, it came with a liability. Once he decided, free moral agents that would be, have the opportunity to be conformed into the likeness of the Son. That's what he was doing. Most of you here, you all didn't know. Did y'all know Chad? Chad McCullough. Okay. Chad, and I used to, you know, sit around and talk about a lot of this kind of stuff, and he transcribed some notes that he gave to me as we had been talking. And Chad was the kind of guy who, you know, for me, I can tell you what people say about the Trinity. I can tell you what I think about most of what somebody says. But Chad was the kind of guy who thought Trinity language. It's kind of like the difference between Tim and I. I can take a light bulb and a switch and some wire, and I can make a light bulb come on. He can tell you what's happening to the electrons at the dam on each side of the we'll see. And, you know, it's always interesting to know how far is that electron going? That's part of that turbine that's, you know, but you've got a transformer where it can't get across. But see, so what I'm saying is when you listen to Chad, this is Chad's own thinking. This is Chad's own, having read all this stuff. He pulls it down and he says, here are some of my conclusions that I have arrived to. I left them in his handwriting, rather than type them off, because for those of you who knew Chad, it's nice to have something in his handwriting, but also to let you know that it is Chad's. But I think it's obviously very, very good, very well done. So it's two pages. Tim will hand you the first one, and I'll hand you the second one. And we'll read this and then talk about it. You afraid somebody come in and see if we got cruel under God's name? Okay. As they used to tell me in the seminary, don't worry about God. He's big enough to take care of himself. You don't have to defend God. Okay. I'm one of those people who don't like people reading things to you. You know, my wife continuously says, let me read this to you. It's hard for me to hear and think at the same time. But if you read along with me, I'll read it out loud, and we'll try to get through this, okay? Now, before I start reading, let me tell you this. The study of the incarnation stretches you. How could Jesus be fully God and fully man? Does he have a will of man? Does he have a nature of man? Does his nature of God so overpower that his nature of man, that he really doesn't have the struggles we have and all that? The church wrestled with that. We'll talk about that as we go along. We talk about the Trinity. We're stretching toward a concept of the first cause of all that is. Certainly we have to say, wow, it's mystery. And we'll walk away with some mystery. But when we at least try, we get a larger view of God. You see, when people talk about God, they would use a phrase when I was growing up, the man upstairs. That's kind of like the landlord that lives on the top floor and all the serfs live underneath him. Well, you know, when you think about God, who our universe is billions of light years across. I mean, that's how far light of travel in a year, billions of years across. You know, how big is God? You know, enormous, enormous. The phone is ringing, we'll let it ring.
Chad always addressed him as sir.
Oh, yes. When he prayed, he would say sir. Yes. So what we do when we try to talk about the Trinity, number one, if we're ever going to witness to people outside of our faith, we have to be able to have some language to talk about Trinity, and because the charge is that we're polytheistic. Okay, the subject is the purpose of God and the consequence. See, God's purpose for creating and the consequence to God of his creation of man. Purpose: to create morally free beings who, like himself, choose good. They thereby turn intent, now that's an important word, turn intent into what? Actuality. In Aristotle's terminology, they actualize. They bring into reality what existed only as potential possible good. Now, even though there can be a lot of evil and pain and suffering in the world, I was they're doing some Medal of Honor awards for some guys in Vietnam. I was reading this last week, and this one guy who they're trying to get the award, give the award to, either his third or fourth tour in Vietnam, he's walking point, and somebody behind him tripped a tripwire, and a grenade fell out into the midst of the group. He ran to get it to try to pitch it out, and realized that he didn't have enough time, so he just put it in his gut and balled up over it and saved the squad. Well, even as, you know, that is a courageous, just a self-sacrifice, courageous. You know, Gail and I have a personal friend who, Nikki Gomez, the only person I ever knew of that, who went AWOL from the hospital after being injured to get back to his troops. And he told him, he said, they're not going to make it without me. When he got back, he got killed. But that, and even in the, and, you know, those are courageous and good, and people who care for their loved ones and whatever, you know, these are only potential goods that become actuality in the universe of existence, that God wanted to have that opportunity to be expressed. Now, by this action, good is increased, which accomplishes the intent of God in recreation, that good would increase. Now, good is moral, is it not?
It's always associated with the truth.
Okay. And so there's such thing as false and truth. There's something as good and bad. You know, for something to be good, it has to be compared to the possibility of something that is bad. And so then that was the purpose as he outlined it. And he said the method. Okay. The method. In order to do this, God presented man with a morally neutral theater in which to actualize the evidence of his choice. Now, what do you think about the expression a morally neutral theater? Why is that? Why would that even be important to God's intent to create?
Is that meaning that in the our realm of existence, there's really no preferential treatment to good or bad? Is that what he's saying?
Yes, and there is no manipulation.
Well, I mean, it's basically, it goes against the Old Testament theology of good happens to good people, bad happens to bad people.
Right. Now, morally neutral theater would mean, as Tim's trying to point out to you there, if by doing good I get more money in the bank, then what's my motivation for being good? To keep doing more good. You know, it is a means to that end. Not being good because it's right to do, you know. Now, a morally neutral theater then gives some evidence for why God allows the spiritual power of darkness. If the only spiritual power that can knock on your door is God, is that a morally neutral theater? All right, now, yeah.
Choices.
Well, see, if the only voice you can have in you is the voice compelling you to do what's right, then you can be overpowered by that voice. As opposed to there's an equal voice in your head that says, ah, it's not that bad. Surely. And so the fact that God allows the power of darkness in our world. Now, we're not dualistic. Dualism says that there are two equal and opposing gods, a good God and an evil God. God allows evil in the world. Apparently, he allows evil in our world because he allowed evil in the spiritual realm. How would you say? He gave them choice, didn't he? The angels were cast down because they made a bad choice. Now, okay, the morally neutral theater says that it's like my neighbor when they was baling hay in his field and the rain was heading our way and I got it baled and as I swung by the house, he said, "You must be paying the preacher. You got that done before the rain got here." And I said, "I am the preacher." And I said, but the facts are, because I am the preacher isn't the reason the rain didn't get here. I'm thankful that it didn't and fortunate that it didn't. But, we will need to talk about this, but there are times when God intervenes in our world and there's times when he doesn't. And and there are times whenever the harshness of weather or the blessing of weather. Jesus said it well when he said, the rain and the sunshine falls.
Just and unjust.
Now, rain and sunshine are not positive and negative. They're two positives. Because I'm going to tell you, you get sunshine, you don't get rain, you're not in good shape. If you get rain, no sunshine, you're not in good shape. So the blessing of that doesn't come because of the just and unjust. In other words, Jesus is saying those are things that come upon everybody. And there's a way in which God could have set the world up that if you do not do what's right, then it's evident. You get punished. That's what Job's friends were trying to do with him. Now, so the purpose was that he could bring potential good into actuality. And if he's going to bring potential good into actuality, what was the method he did that? He put in a morally neutral theater, meaning God's not going to control them, and they're in a place where they can morally choose, and it's a neutral theater that's not going to cater to them if they do, or cater to them if they don't. Okay? Now, the result, that was his purpose, his method was, he puts them in here. The result would be the results of man choosing freely is that he not always chooses good. This has affected the once morally neutral theater such that man now has to deal with not only the challenges of the morally neutral theater, but with the consequence of previous wrong choices. Okay? Big statement, but it's not as complicated as it sounds. Okay. The purpose was to actualize good. And if you're going to actualize good, you got to have opportunity for the opposite. The method was get them a neutral place and let them make choices and work through that. Now, he said the result was because man does not always choose rightly, what's the result? If you cut down the rainforest in Brazil, what happens to the weather? It changes. And if you have the freedom to make any widget or gadget you want, and people do. People say, "I don't want 20 bushels per acre of corn. I want 100 bushels of acre by corn." And so we're going to genetically modify the corn And we're going to ramp up the power of the fertilizer. And you're going to get that 100 bushel an acre. On the downside of that, the genetic engineering and ramping up of the fertilizer has consequences. And or people who make plastics or any other kind of thing that they're going to, you know, revolutionize the packaging industry with, they make them and the byproduct of the thing they make is not a good thing. Carcinogenic. Cancers. Now, we've created, because of wrong choices, how many people died because they didn't understand to keep their waste away from where they live and not letting their human waste become part of their drinking system again? And they died. You know, you understand our choices can affect the neutral theater. Okay. And the previous wrong choices of people even before us give us some of these things. Now, go to page 2. Page 2. There was a consequence to all of this. God once dwelt in a setting that perfectly reflected his own perfection, now shares this setting with a created, finite, made in his image, who is free to choose rightly or wrongly, God's image being us, has sometimes chosen wrongly, bringing into actuality not good, and that was never God's intention. You know, when people want to put evil, pain, and suffering at the feet of God, a great deal of it is our own. This is the price God paid to actualize good. It was the price he knowingly paid, knowing beforehand that this was the cost of his creating a finite, time-bound creature with the moral power to actualize, bring into reality that which existed only as potential, good or not good. He decided to let his image dwell, even if imperfectly, rather than stay in his perfection in his creation. Here's a famous statement. He absorbed the blow to his perfection as reflected in his created order as the price of his intent to increase good, meaning that Jesus was crucified before the foundation of the world. Now, a lot said here. Let me give you some more meat to go on to the concept. All right. When God decided to create, he didn't create because he had a need. He created to bring into actuality more good. But in order to do that, there had to be the possibility that it would bring more bad, and it did. But God was willing to absorb that blow in order to carry forth his intention, meaning that when we choose wrongly and go away from what he intends, he absorbs the blow of that so that it might be the possibility of others that will choose rightly. He absorbs the blow by willing to allow the Son to come and die to redeem us from our bad choices. And that's how far he was willing to go to absorb the blow. Now, in order for us to be morally free agents, God has to sit back and watch us make good choices and bad choices, help and hurt. He absorbs that blow. But in order to absorb the blow fully, he has to be willing to say, I've got to come to redeem them from themselves in order to get them to the fullness of the goal that I had. When I think about God, I always come back to this thing that Chad, you know, gave me not long before. Well, let's see, when was it? 01? When did Chad die? Do you remember? 02? Okay. We had been attended twice a week-long study. Ravi Zachariah, who is a quite famous apologetic in our world today, conference of his in, I think, we go to Chattanooga or Atlanta? I don't remember where we went. But anyhow, this was part of our conversation as a result of those meetings. Now, okay. Point being is, the worst thing that we can do with trying to wrap our hands around the Trinity is, as I said earlier, okay. All right, the Godhead. Three persons sitting around a table trying to agree on what we're going to do. We need this distinctiveness in the Godhead. Why do we need the distinctiveness in the Godhead? So that God can be loving and relational within himself. If not, he only becomes loving, relational after he makes us. There has to be an object for that. He can't be personality. I can't be personality to a tree. I can't. You know, I mean, but there are not three persons sitting around here trying to agree together. That's a concept we have to try to get out of our head, because number one, person one has to be in this box, person two has to be in this box, person three has to be in this box. But we already said there's not a box for God. God's not got that spatial limitation. Now, in wrestling through, what happened is, within the Godhead, there was a decision to create. And the three distinctiveness within the Godhead decided it would be worth the risk to take to do it. And so when Jesus says, I've come to do the will of the Father, which sounds like, who's in charge?
The Father.
But what he's saying is, I've come to do the will of the Godhead. And we are in perfect, the three distinctiveness of God is in complete agreement about what they're doing. It wasn't a 2-to-1 vote. And so they are all submitting to the will of the Godhead. The Spirit comes, the Son comes to do the will of the Father, saying we're doing the will of the Godhead. The Spirit comes to glorify Christ and the Father in the whole will that was put forth to do. Now, once again, we are body. Shoot my body and I'll die. But I'm not more than my body. You know, I'm spirit and I'm person. And yet I'm unified together in that. Body, personality, and spirit. You know, there's a spiritual soulish dimension of me. Emotion, will, those kind of things. There's a body that my heart pumps, my lungs pump. That's still a part of me. Without the three of us together, take any one of us apart, and you don't have us, you don't have me. Right? And that's one of the better models for Trinity, that if you take any one of these out, you don't have the Godhead. And they can't be separated from each other. You can't shoot my body and not kill me. You can't kill me spiritually and me not be gone. You know, I'm, you know, if you, if you fry my brain, then I'm not person anymore. And any part of that, you know, and yet there are distinctions even within ourselves. I know my body hurts, but it doesn't hurt my spirit, right? I'm distinct in that way, and yet I can identify with me and my person and my personality. My personality can be happy, glad, sad, mad, you know, and it's not a product of whether I ate or not. Sometimes it is, but, you know, that's not what caused me to be one way or the other.
Do you have any objection to viewing God as being in the past, Jesus being in the present, and the Spirit as an entity that works and goes with you in the future? Those three, it unifies time in a certain way.
Yeah. Yeah, except that when we start talking about God, we say that God existed before time. There's no past, present, or future with God. There is the eternal moment. And that's another dimension of God, that there's a timelessness of God.
When you're looking at it from time ago, this side of the veil,
yeah,
we're time-bound.
Yeah. Okay, now all I attempted to do tonight, once again, is to say, stretch your thinking about God. Get a larger concept than just God is just kind of right there at the roof line, or he's right there at the where the sky's limit is, that sort of thing. You know, the concept of God is huge, and we need to kind of really stretch out. And so.